Rowan Shaughness Orchestra with El Banico here on the International Happy Station. You can check us out online at www.pcjmedia.com. Now, for regular listeners, as you may know, for the past few weeks, I have been running a Morse code message on the show, which is a coded message to for you to enter the lucky draw. And as I've said before, it's not important that you understand what Morse code is, but that you heard the message and you mentioned at what time and at what date you heard it, what came before it and what came after that. We had so many people, David, that have entered this contest that it's quite interesting. And I will be announcing the winners today from Hong Kong between 16 and 18 hours UTC. That's today between 16 and 18 hours UTC for listeners in North America, the winners of the Happy Station End of the Year contest. Now, you still can enter. You have today until 15 hours UTC to enter the lucky draw. The Morse code message is coming up now, which I didn't bring again, so that's my problem, but I'll do it for you. Beep, 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 beep. Okay, that's the short version. Send your emails to enter to pcj.happystation@gmail.com. That's pcj.happystation@gmail.com. The prizes are, number one, the first prize is a Sanjin ATS-909 shortwave receiver. The second prize is a Sanjin ATS-606A shortwave receiver. The third prize are the three books by Jerry Berg about international shortwave broadcasting. The fourth prize is a one-year membership to the magazine Communication by the BDXC. That's the British DX Club. The fifth prize is going out to 10 lucky winners, and you'll be receiving one copy each of the CD Easy Come, Easy Go from Tom Meyer, songs that he recorded for the Happy Station in the 1970s and 80s. So you have still a few hours to go to enter. Again, once the email address is pcj.happystation@gmail.com. And my special guest today is David Monson. And as I said earlier, he's bringing a little class to today's show. I actually want to mention this because your son is studying piano, Ali. Mm-hmm. And last week we did a recording of him playing a absolutely beautiful grand piano.
Yeah, Fazioli.
Fazioli.
The biggest piano of it, yeah, in the world, grand piano.
It is the biggest one in the world.
Right, 308, yeah.
So, do you play yourself?
Well, let's put it this way. I used to. All I'm basically capable of doing today is perhaps improvising.
But you did select something else for us. Played on a keyboard, but is it a keyboard? What do you have next for us?
What am I going to play for you now? All right, yeah. Another classical slot. Well, from Beethoven, we're going to go to a Danish composer. Niels Willem Gade, I think that's the way you pronounce it. I have trouble with the pronunciation of my own name, which is also Danish, incidentally, you know, Keith. Munsen, there are plenty of Munsens in the Danish telephone directory, Copenhagen telephone directory. But Gade was one of the, yes, great Danish composers of his time. He was also, like Bach, there's a little thematic, isn't it? He was also a composer, conductor, a violinist, an organist, and a teacher. Mm. And as I say, the most important musician of his day in Copenhagen. You could say, I suppose, Mendelssohn was his mentor because he had a little difficulty, I think, having one of his works played in Denmark. And he sent it to Symphony and he sent it to Mendelssohn, who was then in Leipzig. Mm-hmm. I think he was the conductor of the Gewandhaus Orchestra even then. And Mendelssohn, I like it, you know, and said, come down here, come on down, which he did. He went down to Leipzig and he ended up, in fact, after Mendelssohn died, he ended up taking over the conductorship, I think, of the Gewandhaus Orchestra for a while. Now, what we're going to listen to today is, I can say a lot more about him, but let me see. We're going to listen to is it the scherzo? Yes, also the scherzo. Sorry, Keith, it's not. It doesn't run for about 6 minutes. It's 3:49.
Oh, okay.
Which gives me a little more time and you a little more time to babble, right? To babble.
Go ahead and babble. It's kind of refreshing to be able to sit back and listen to some babbling instead of doing it.
I'm a babbler. I'm a babbler. I know I am. My students tell me that too. Please slow Slow down. Well, I try to do that. It's a scherzo, the allegro moderato et tranquillo, just to be, you know, really musicological and all that. And it's played by, again, I have to read from the back of the cover here, La Arcibaldelli and Masonian Chamber Players. And one of the violin cellist, is none other than Anna Bielsma, right? On the baroque cello once again. We're going to listen to this movement, Keith, yes. This movement, the Scherzo Allegro Moderato et Tranquillo. Unforgivable, Keith, unforgivable. You know what? I forgot to announce the title of that work, right? It's the Octet. The Octet for four violins, two violas, and two violoncellos. Two cellos in F major by Niels Willem Gade, the the Danish composer, who, as I told you, was kind of mentored by Mendelssohn, worked with Mendelssohn as the assistant conductor mm-hmm. of the Gewandhaus Orchestra in Leipzig. He finally had to go back to Copenhagen, unhappily. And just a word here, I have to get this in, absolutely, because I didn't really know this work. I knew the Mendelssohn Octet, I didn't really know the one by Garde. But the amazing thing is that the quartet is using the Ole Bull violin. Now, mm-hmm. what does Ole Bull mean? It didn't mean much to me until, of course, I came to Taiwan. And I realized that the Ole Bull violin is now in the collection, in the Chime collection.
Oh, right.
Here in Taiwan, right? It was sold, obviously, in an American collection, in the collection of the Smithsonian, possibly, before. I don't know how. Maybe it was auctioned off at, I don't know the history. I must go into that. Auctioned off in London, or by Christie's, or by with the other great auction house. I can't remember. It doesn't matter. Sotheby's, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Anyhow, it's now in Taiwan.
Oh, right.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Well, you know, that's nothing. There's a doctor that I recently interviewed.
Right.
He's a dentist, and he studied in the Netherlands at a dentistry school in Rotterdam, and he was there for a number of years. And when he came back to Taiwan, he didn't bring, let's say, clogs or a little wooden windmill. Or delve, or something like that. No, he brought back a barrel organ. And I don't mean a little toy barrel organ, but I mean a barrel organ that would literally fit inside this room, like a really big barrel organ. And since that time, since he's been back, he's bought some other ones as well. He is the only barrel organ collector in all of Asia.
Well, isn't it amazing where so much of our European heritage is landing up, cultural heritage, right? A barrel organ? Well, that doesn't surprise me either, in a way. I remember many years ago, again, nostalgia, mm-hmm. memories. But I know they've closed that museum as well, somewhere in West Flandern, on the coast, a place called Coxeter.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be an organ museum there, or, a traditional instrument museum, and barrel organs, among other, every possible kind of organ, right? Pianolas, etc., of course, mm-hmm. were part of that exhibition. So it's a pity, the museum, and it's a pity to know that that also has closed.
Yeah, it's also gone. All right, you're listening to the International Happy Station, and this hour we've gone to South Africa, we've gone to the United States, we've gone to Japan, and now we head up all the way to Montreal, Canada, with my good buddy Beta Wayne, who I worked with a number of years ago. He does a show called Comedy Crackers that airs on CINQ in Montreal, and he sent us a little bit of a comedy greeting.
Well, Happy New Year to all your listeners around the world, Keith. I've chosen a couple of my favorite pieces, but first, let's go into the kitchen and eavesdrop on Marge and Gloria.
More coffee, Marge? Thanks, Gloria. Gee, your enclave is a lot more ethnically clean than mine. Thanks. You know, I tried something new.
Really?
Yes. New Ultra Serb. For powerful ethnic cleansing, nothing else even comes close.
Serb?
Mm-hmm. But that's been around for years.
I know, but it's been reformulated for extra cleaning power. Not even the UN can stand up to the wallop in just a townful. Think I ought to try Ultra Serb for my tough ethnic cleansing problems?
When you put the concentrated rifle power of Ultra Serb up against anything else, it's no contest.
I think I will have more coffee, Gloria.
Ultra Serb. For real ethnic cleansing. Anything else is a washout.
Well, at New Year's, everybody's talking about food and eating and celebrating. And I thought we would play some John Panette. Now, John Panette is a big man. He loves food. He loves eating. He loves celebrating any occasion he gets. And in this one, John Panette is off to the Oz Buffet, and then some Chinese buffet, and some more Chinese buffet. I hope you'll enjoy it.
In Vegas, my favorite buffet has to be the Oz Buffet, the MGM Grand, because The Wizard of Oz, my favorite movie, and they made it a buffet. I'm sorry, I always get a little choked up. You walk up, it's the Emerald City, and it's a buffet. I ran to it. You're out of the woods, you're out of the dark, you're out of the night.
the sunset under the light. Prime ribs and pork chops and scampi. Oh, my. They have a Glinda there. Are you a good witch or a bad witch? I want a sandwich. Get out of my way. I would gobble all the vittles to fortify my middles. All the Hindus would be barfing at the cows that I was scarfing. The Wizard of Oz, and it's a buffet. Oh. Somewhere over the buffet, food piled high, there's a meal I must get to. Stop me and you will die. Somewhere over the buffet, watch me fly, eating up all of the profits, making the owner cry. Someday I'll have my own buffet where no one can tell me to stop eating. With prime ribs, pork chops, pizza, ham, a gastronomic wonderland. I'll be at every seating. If scrawny, skinny men can fly beyond the buffet, why, oh, why can't I? I'd like to talk a little bit about Chinese buffets. I don't know if you knew this new development, but I'm not allowed anymore. They all have my picture with a big slash through it. No buffet. Buffet not for you. You order from menu. You order a la carte. A la carte, yes. It's not my fault, though. With Chinese food, you get hungry again. Why is that? It's a different kind of hunger. You go from full to starving. Nothing in between. You go, oh, my God, I can't believe I ate all that chow mein. Hey, look, they brought egg rolls. Two, please. I went to a grand opening of a Chinese buffet. I got a flyer in the mail. And it said grand opening, and I go there with a couple of the large mammal friends. And the owner meets us at the door. We closed. Says grand opening, pal. No, we closed. No buffet here. We dry clean now. I do your jacket, ready Friday. Now go. You cause trouble. I went to this one Chinese buffet, and I must say the owner was a little rude. I mean, he'd come out every hour. And look, he's still here. He go again. What he was doing, I found out, was putting more MSG in the food as I went up. So about the seventh or eighth time, I was slipping into an MSG coma. I had that never say die spirit, though. I was crawling to that buffet. Must get to lo mein. I give him enough MSG, kill an elephant. He still keep going. You can't stop him. You go now. You're here 4 hours. Why you're here 4 hours? You no come here anymore. Why you have spare rib? You're so big. Eat vegetable. Eat broccoli. You'll scare my wife.
You go now!
So to all of your listeners for the year 2010, the very best. I hope you enjoyed John Panette and that little piece involving Marge and Gloria.
All right. Thank you very much, Beta Wayne. Beta Wayne does do a show called Comedy Crackers. Oh, you can hear sounds like a fire truck or ambulance somewhere in the background. One of the windows is open somewhere. There we go. Yes. It's currently 2:23 UTC, and I just want to quickly run down what we have coming up today between 16 and 1800 hours for the special edition of Happy Station coming to you from RTHK overlooking Victoria Harbour in Hong Kong. We're going to be signing on the moment the fireworks happen in Victoria Harbour. We're also going to be going around the world. Chrissy Brand from the BBXC is going to be joining us. Paulette McCrory is going to be joining us from Vancouver, Canada, talking about a Ukrainian New Year's Eve. And I know Paulette McCrory doesn't... It sounds more Scottish than Ukrainian, but she actually is Ukrainian. King David McKenzie... And one time I called him William Lyon Mackenzie King, named after the Canadian Prime Minister, and he went, he's dead. I said, well, you know, made a mistake. Peter Anthony Holder, producer, presenter of The Stuff File, is going to join us to talk about some of the odd news stories from 2009, including a woman who had to go to court because of her, well, noisy lovemaking that was disturbing the neighbors. A court case that happened in London.
Good Lord.
Yeah, and they spent thousands, well, millions of British pounds, taxpayers' monies, to go after it. And then Tom Meyer will join us from Flevoland, at his home in Holland, to talk about what is going to happen at the New Year's in Holland. And that's coming up today between 16 and 1800 UTC for the edition of Happy Station for North America and the Caribbean on 9,955 kilohertz. Check us out online at www.pcjmedia.com. That's www.pcjmedia.com to find out the details. Coming up in a few moments, Ian McFarland and Colin Newell will be sending in their recorded segment from British Columbia, Canada. But first, I want to dedicate the next song to a longtime listener of ours by the name of Yvonne Glewis, who happens to live in Tasmania. And Yvonne listens to a few editions of the show. She listens to the version for New Zealand, which is carried on World FM through their website. And then she also listens to the version for South America and the Caribbean at 2 hours UTC. Now, of course, we're not at 2 hours UTC. We've been going for longer than that. Because, as I said earlier, this show is 120 minutes. But Yvonne suggested that she said, I would like you to have you play a song for me. And, well, since we have a little bit of comedy, I thought we'd choose something a little bit odd. And I know some Australians right now are going to go, what's all this, mate? You're making fun of us? A dingo's got me baby, waltzing Matilda and me tucker bag. And have some Vegemite as well. I love Australian lingo. Vegemite, tucker bag, you know, Billy Bong and Tukaluka. And there's actually a place, believe it or not, in Australia called Wagga Wagga.
You've been there?
No, I haven't been there, but imagine that, a Wagga Wagga.
Wagga Wagga, actually. Well, it sounds a bit like some of the places I know in South Africa.
Yeah. So for, what's her name again? Yes, Yvonne Glewis, all the way in Tasmania, Australia. Let's have a little bit of one of your fellow countrymen, Rolf Harris, and Click Go the Shears.
Click go the shears, boys, click, click, click. Wide is his blow and his hands move quick. The ringer looks around and he's beaten by a blow and curses the old snagger with the blue-bellied Joe.
Well, a blue-bellied Joe is a sheep with its stomach completely bare of wool. A snagger is a lucky fella. What else? The ringer is the champion of the shearing team. That's enough, let's go.
Out on the boards, the old shearer stands, grasping his shears in his thin, bony hands. Fixed is his eye on the blue-bellied Joe, and glory if he gets her, won't he make the ringer go? Oh, click, go the shears, boys, click, click, click. Wide is his blow and his hands move quick. The ringer looks around and he's beaten by a blow and curses the old snagger with the blue-bellied Joe. Out in the middle, on his cane-bottomed chair, sits the boss of the joint with his eyes everywhere. He watches every fleece as it comes up to the screen, pays particular attention if it's taken off clean. Click, go the shears, boys, click, click, click. Wide is his blow and his hands move quick. The ringer looks around and he's beaten by a blow and curses the old snagger with the blue-bellied Joe. Well, the tar boy is there and he's in great demand with his blackened tar pot in his tarry hand. He sees an old sheep with the cut upon her back, and this is what he's waiting for. Tar here, Jack! Oh, click, go the shears, boys, click, click, click. Wide is his blow and his hands move quick. The ringer looks around and he's beaten by a blow and curses the old snagger with the blue-bellied Joe. Well, the colonial experience man, he is there, of course, with his shiny leggings like he just got off his horse. He casts his blooming eyes around just like a connoisseur, and you can hear him whistling, ain't I the perfect lure? Oh, click, go the shears, boys, click, click, click. Wide is his blow and his hands move quick. The ringer looks around and he's beaten by a blow and curses the old snagger with the blue-bellied Joe. Well, the shearing is over, we've all had our pay. Pack up your swags, boys, and let's be on our way. The first pub we come to, we'll all have a spree, with everybody shouting out, have a drink with me. Click, go the shears, boys, click, click, click. Wide is his blow and his hands move quick. The ringer looks around and he's beaten by a blow and curses the old snagger with the blue-bellied Joe.
Ralph Harris going out to Yvonne Lewis with Click Go the Shears, and to all our other friends all the way down under in Australia, give me a tucker bag. You're listening to the International Happy Station Show, and you know, we still have a few minutes before we get to Colin Newell and Ian McFarland, but you know, I always found it interesting to hear, you know, Happy New Year said in many different languages. Now, here in Taiwan, at this moment, it's 11:30 in the morning, and we're already December 31st. But our listeners who are listening to this, it's still December 30th. So, somebody said to me a while ago, how do you say Happy New Year in Chinese? Well, the only two ways that I can say it are in Mandarin, which is Gong Xi Fa Chai, and Cantonese with his Gong Hei Fa Choi.
Oh, that's a new one on me.
Gong Hei Fa Choi, which is the Cantonese. But surprisingly, if you know enough Chinese dialects, because there's over 50 Chinese dialects, you can say it in Shanghainese, Beijingese, Mongolian, and so many different ones. And I used to know how to say it in Taiwanese, but I've forgotten that. But anyway, the most standard way for that question is, yes, it is Gong Xi Fa Chai in Mandarin, and in Cantonese, Gong Hei Fa Choi. And what about, can you say it in Flemish?
Well, I suppose we say Gelukkige Nieuwjaar. Gelukkige Nieuwjaar, no? Isn't that how we say it?
Yes, yes, yes.
In Dutch.
In Dutch, right? And Afrikaans?
Afrikaans, have a great new year.
Have a great new year. We're going to go and kill some elephants, Min.
Probably, right. Ever been to the Kruger National Park, Keith? That's somewhere I've got to
Beautiful place. Yeah. Beautiful place. You know, there's...
Right.
just a while ago, there's... I don't know if you remember a comedy program from the United Kingdom called Spitting Image.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a song on the show called You'll Never Meet a Nice White South African.
Oh, really?
It was a hysterical song. And one of these days I will play it. Neil, our good buddy in South Africa, who was on the show the first hour, heard it. He thought it was the funniest thing, you know, because the person who's singing the song did it like that. You know what I'm saying? Okay, right, here we go. Okay, Afrikaans is like messy Dutch.
Well, I mean... Interesting thing about Afrikaans, very briefly. You know, it's still very much alive and well in South Africa. Mm. You know why? Yes, because, of course, the mulatto population in Cape Town, you know, they call them the Cape Coloureds. That's not being pejorative, but these are wonderful people and incredibly musical. And they have really kept the language live in theater, in culture generally.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're running out of time, so now we have to cut to our final piece for today that has been sent to us by Colin Newell and Ian McFarland, who you know from Radio Japan, BBC, and of course Radio Canada International.
Each morning when I go from a squamoth to court.
That's the folk duo Two Old Goats on their album Island Standard Time with the E&N Blues. Welcome to special program for DXR.ca and Happy Station. Conversations with Ian McFarland, past, present, and future. His story and mine. Enjoy. We're standing on a rocky abyss in Jordan River, British Columbia, looking out over the Olympic Peninsula. And I'm talking to
Ian McFarland,
formerly of Radio Canada International, NHK Japan, and the BBC World Service. Here in the 21st century, we often think of internet broadcasting and radio broadcasting as a just-in-time operation where one person alone creates a program, puts it on the air, and reaches the world. Looking back at the 70s and 80s, the heyday, the solid days of shortwave broadcasting, we often associate programs that Ian McFarland would have produced as something that was done with a team of writers and producers and technicians. Apparently, that's not the case. Ian, in fact, was often a one-man operation, just like we are today. And the reality is that little has changed. So let's let Ian have a word or two about what it was like producing 20-minute programs in the 70s and 80s on a 10-minute studio budget.
Yeah, there is one drawback to doing quite a number of programs in a week, especially if you can't get enough material together to put into the program. And I can remember one time what I would do was record all my programs, put them on, they're all on tape, boxed up, and then the last thing I did on Friday was take all the tapes into the studio and put them in the proper time slots. Now, of course, it's all computerized. Nobody puts tapes in studios anymore. It's all done from master control by computer. But this one time, I had a program called the In-Bit, which was a program basically aimed at a younger audience. And it was usually two or three items in the program. And I was running short of studio time this one week. So I quickly did the program. And then on Monday morning, somebody, the head of the department, passed me the studio fault report, commonly known in the business as the dirt sheet, where all the transgressions go that the studio technician notes. And under the program heading the In-Bit, program too short, fill music used. So I checked the tape, and what I had done was I'd gone into the studio, I'd recorded all the intros, the extro, the next intro, the next extro, and so on, and the final end of the program, with the idea I'd go back to my office, splice in the actual items that I'd introduced, and as it turned out, in my rush and tear to get away on that Friday, I'd forgotten to splice in all the items. So the tape lasted about, maybe 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes. And I'm sure the listener must have wondered, what the hell is going on with this program? It goes bleep, 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 bleep. And that was the end of the program. So that's one of the drawbacks of too much to do in a week and not enough studio time to do it in. So that's the only time that ever happened. It's things like that you learn by doing, and you don't repeat it if you can help it.
I can just imagine you introducing a program. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming. Yeah. Have a nice day. One of the greatest challenges for the international broadcaster, whether it's on radio or via the internet, is actually finding an audience. And what we know of our audience in North America is that listeners like stuff. Winning stuff, getting stuff, free stuff, pennants, stamps, you name it. We know the listeners are out there, but what does it take to get them inspired to report in and say, look, we're hearing your program, we're enjoying your program? In the 70s and 80s, things were much the same for Ian McFarland in promoting the Voice of Canada. Let's hear it from Ian, what kind of experience he had while running promotions.
Well, for many, many years, Canadian stamps were, in my opinion, some of the most ugly and unimaginative stamps you'd ever want to see. But there was a turning point where stamp design in Canada had some class to it. It had some style, and they were very nice. A stark contrast to what they used to be. And on my Canada a la carte program, one particular month, we're always looking for ideas to make it more interesting for the listeners. So I figured stamp collecting / philately. It's the world's most common hobby. Every kid saves stamps, and a lot of adults do. Kings and queens save stamps. So it's a very popular hobby, or so I thought. So I decided I'd have a contest on Canada a la carte this one particular month. So I was offering nice corner blocks, full sheets of very attractive stamps. So I ran the contest for a full month on the program. And I sat and waited for entries, and waited, and waited. And at one point, I had one entry, and that was from somebody I knew who said, well, Ian, I'd like to enter your contest. At least you'll have one entry. And as it turned out, by the end of the month, I did in fact have one entry, and it was that one, and it was from Jeff White, who, of course, runs WRMI in Miami, Florida now. So we both had a good laugh on that occasion that his entry was the only one that I got for the contest. So what do I do with all these stamps? So I just found another use for them and mailed letters.
In the 70s and 80s, the solid days of shortwave listening and DXing, our clubs like SpeedX and the IRCA would often have upwards of 1,000 members, and with that, any number of people running the organization in the background. And yet at the time, the world of broadcasters was one of isolation and one-man shows. In this conversation with Ian McFarland, he illustrates how, on some level, conventions like ANARC actually brought together broadcasters and the broadcasters and their listeners at the same time. Ian, could you sort of describe how this originally happened with ANARC conventions, how you ended up with broadcasters sitting down talking to their listeners directly?
Well, I'd been to a number of EDXE conferences in various parts of Europe in the 70s, and there was always a very large broadcaster participation in the EDXE conferences. And it occurred to me that maybe this would be a good thing to have in a North American context, because ANARC conventions just sort of happened. They were organized by one member club or another of ANARC, but there was never any broadcaster participation. And of course, this was back in the 70s and 80s when broadcasters had money in their budgets to cover travel. I think the first of the ANARC conventions that I organized at RCI was in 1978, and I organized a one-day broadcasters conference that was just for broadcasters. It gave some North American broadcasters and European broadcasters, Asian broadcasters, a chance to sit down and talk with each other, because as you mentioned, we all sort of worked in isolation. And this worked out very well indeed. And all of the broadcasters discovered that they weren't alone with regard to their managements. Some of the people that attended were in management at various stations, but in a lot of stations, management people are also on the air, which is not the case in certainly with RCI. Management never did get on the air. So it gave us a chance to talk amongst ourselves and find out that we all had the same sorts of problems with our management. We all felt that management didn't really know what they were talking about in many instances, and it was always very frustrating. So this worked out very well, and by virtue of having the broadcasters' conference, the broadcasters stayed for the NARC convention itself, so it gave the broadcasters a good opportunity to talk amongst their listeners, which they very seldom got a chance to do, certainly not in North America. So I also started organizing to take advantage of the presence of the broadcasters at the NARC conventions, an international broadcasters forum. And this, all of the ones that I organized for NARC conventions, even though I wasn't organizing it for RCI, if it was held somewhere else, I'd organize a broadcasters conference, a one-day conference ahead of the NARC convention. And the broadcaster forum, to the best of my recollection, was always the best attended session of any NARC convention. What we did was line up all the broadcasters up on a stage, and everybody get a chance to talk for a couple of minutes about their broadcasting organization. And then when everybody done that, the floor was thrown open to the listeners to ask whatever broadcaster they wanted to get an answer from about their station, why their signal was so lousy in the North American target area, why they broadcast at a certain time when there were very few listeners around. So it was a very good learning experience. And people didn't limit their questions to sort of fuzzy questions that would get an ordinary answer. They would tell the broadcasters what they thought, and I think the broadcasters enjoyed that because it told them exactly what their listeners were thinking, and it worked out very well.
I asked Ian if he had a budget and an audience and a broadcasting facility, what two or three things would he be doing right now in the year 2010?
That's a hard choice to make, but if I go back to my days at Radio Canada International, I think the program, I know the Shortwave Listeners Digest had a big audience, and I was amazed at some trips I made to EDXE conferences in Europe, what some listeners went through to actually try and hear the program every week. There would be interference and fading and everything else, and it was quite amazing the antics some people would have to go through to get a decent signal on the program. But I think the one program that I enjoyed doing the most and was the most fun was the mailbag program, because it gave me a chance to research answers to listeners' questions, and I remember that somebody asked a question about what the favorite snack food in Canada was, and as it turned out, it was potato chips, the kind you buy in a bag, not French fries, it was potato chips. So I went and interviewed somebody at a potato chip factory that wasn't too far from where I lived. And somebody also asked a question about Canadian whiskey. So I went and interviewed the chief blender at a distillery in Montreal. So those were interesting things, and it gave me a chance to find out a little more about my own country, I think, than I knew off the top of my head. So there were a few crazy questions as well, and they were fun to answer. But I think, of course, doing the mailbag at RCI, the whole premise of the mailbag program was to answer questions about Canada. And, of course, not being with RCI anymore, that whole premise is gone. But I think it would be an interesting challenge to do something like a mailbag program when you're not connected with any particular broadcaster or country. Be an interesting experiment, I think.
In the year 2010, my wife and I enjoy food and drink and travel and actually writing about food and drink and travel and getting paid to do so from time to time. In Ian's world, you'd hardly think for a second he was actually retired with the number of activities he have. I was just talking to Ian about some of the things that he likes to do, but they sound awfully familiar, a lot like work. So what exactly is it that you're doing now that you call your pastime or your favorite activities?
Well, I guess you would call it volunteering, because I'm involved in three different organizations and none of them produce any income. I'm the president, not a very onerous job this, but president of the Vancouver Island chapter of the CBC Pensioners National Association. They have a number of chapters in various parts of Canada. And as I said, that's not a terribly onerous job. We organize two luncheons every year, one in the spring and one in the fall, to get at least all the members that live in the Victoria, BC area together for a nice lunch. And then for the last, I guess 7 or 8 years, I've been involved with the local food bank in Duncan, British Columbia, the city I live in. And I'm on the board of the society. It's a nonprofit society that runs the food bank, which also is a soup kitchen, and it's one of very, very few on Vancouver Island that is also a soup kitchen, and that runs 6 days a week. The hamper operation runs Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and I do all the food purchasing for the food bank. And this is the same food bank that's been the beneficiary of all the CD sales that we've been doing over the last couple of years.
And for the benefit of those that live in societies, perhaps in Western Europe or Eastern Europe, that never have heard of a food bank, would you describe for a moment what a food bank actually is and what it does?
Well, it provides a once-a-month hamper of food. And the size of this hamper of food depends on the size of the family. And we serve anywhere from single mothers with one or two kids, or single fathers with a couple of kids, to very large families. Many of them are First Nations families, Aboriginal people of Canada. And we have basic foodstuffs like rice and sugar and powdered milk, or a liter of regular milk, and some macaroni and cheese dinners, soup, peanut butter, that sort of thing, staples basically. And this is designed to help people out. These are people whose incomes are perhaps not very large. They're on limited incomes. These days, there are a lot of what we call working poor who are working for minimum wage. And even if you're working full-time at minimum wage, it makes it very difficult to pay your rent and have an awful lot of money left over for food. And the food bank operates virtually exclusively on public donations. We get a few grants from the British Columbia government, from the gaming funds. The province gets a lot of income from gambling. And we buy a lot of the food with this money. We also get a lot of food donations. Companies and grocery store chains quite often will donate goods that the packaging has changed, or something goes wrong with the label. They have I know we got a big shipment of soup at one point, and all because the 1-800 number for customers to call was wrong on the label. So they had to get rid of it. Perfectly good soup. So it's a dual sort of operation, and the annual budget is well over $100,000 a year. And as I say, it's almost all just from public donations. But in addition to that, and the food bank is getting busier and busier and busier as the economy slides a bit. A lot of people in the area that the food bank serves have lost their jobs. People might be in the forestry industry. That is not doing well these days. So it's a business that unfortunately is not going to go out of business anytime soon. And I know in many parts of the world, this sort of thing is handled by the government and people get enough to live on. But rents in the area served by our food bank are relatively high. And it's difficult to find affordable accommodation, even in an apartment, a small apartment. So for a lot of people, there's not much money left at the end of the month for food. But the hampers of food that we give out are not designed to keep people going for an entire month. For a family of, say, 8 or 10, the amount of groceries they will get would probably keep them going for a week. But for the last 4 years, since 2005, I've been president of another nonprofit society that started up some people might know them as daycare centers, but ours are early learning centers. It's anywhere from 6 months. We have a number of different programs. We have an infant toddler program that will serve children that are from six to eight months to a couple of years old, 3 years old. Then we have the next stage up is preschool, which is 3 and 4 year olds, and 5 year olds sometimes as well. And this keeps me quite busy because we've gone from at the start we had one qualified teacher and maybe a handful of children. Now we're running programs in 5 different elementary schools. The spaces we use are spaces in elementary schools where the enrollment has shrunk and the space is just empty. So we've gone in there and set up daycare centers and early learning programs to fill a need. There's a huge need for it because more and more families have both parents working, and daycare can be very, very expensive. So really, this particular volunteer job brings me right back full circle because my wife and I were both involved in something called Parent Participation Preschools, which was a preschool the year before children go into kindergarten. It gives them a head start on their education, and it's extremely valuable. We've proved that the children that have gone through our early childhood education programs are way ahead in kindergarten, way ahead of children who didn't go to preschool. Their number skills are better, their speaking skills are better. So my wife Mary and I were very much involved in this. The parents actually run the preschool back in 1968, this was. And everybody has their duty day. Even the fathers, you go in and you're an assistant teacher, effectively, for your duty day. So this takes me right back to where it all began. And, of course, after that, I was involved in home and school associations, which are known as parent-teacher associations in the U.S., I know. And I got to the ultimate point where I was an elected school board trustee for 4.5 to 5 years. So it's all gone full circle. I've started again.
All right. Thank you very much, Ian McFarlane and Colin Newell. We are running out of time. Before we end off, I do want to thank David Monson for coming by today and co-hosting this special two-hour edition of Happy Station for listeners in South America, Latin America, and the Caribbean. Now, David, you have something that you're going to play, you've chosen to for us to end off with today.
Well, yes, let's end with the work, the Toccata, by the French composer Charles-Marie Widor, the finest symphonic, or one of the finest symphonic organ composers of the late 19th, early 20th century. And it's played on the grand organ of the Saint-Sernin Cathedral, right, in Toulouse. And here it goes. Originally written, it was rumoured for funerals, but I think very appropriate to play this work to end your programme today, Keith. So here it goes then, the Toccata from the Symphony No. 10 by Widor.
All right, David, thank you very much. Join me today at 16 hours UTC for another two-hour special edition of Happy Station coming to you from Hong Kong. I will see you then. Take care, everyone, and God bless. Or God bless, I should say. Oh, what a day.